Once a month, Barbara and Johnny and I go to Stony Brook Assisted Living, and people there are mostly old, older than me, a lot older than me even. And so they like the hymns, and I say that because I guess they grew up. There's one called "O Thou Fount of Every Blessing," and it's about a guy who's so grateful for what Jesus has done for him. And in the middle of it, it says, "Here thy praises I'll begin. Here I raise my Ebenezer. Here by thy great help I've come." What is an Ebenezer? It's like weird because you know the only Ebenezer I knew was Ebenezer Scrooge, right? So I have this room picking up Ebenezer Scrooge, and it's not working for me. So I looked it up. First of all, why it was Ebenezer Scrooge named Ebenezer? Because in the old days, people knew the Bible. One of the old days, 17th, 18th century, they didn't have as many books, and they tended to read the Bible a lot more, I think, or hear it a lot more than we do now. And they used biblical names. We still do that. Daniel's a biblical name. Caleb's a biblical name. Samuel, Joshua, Joseph. They're very familiar, but you know, if we hear somebody named Ebenezer, we think, where'd that come from? But it's just another Bible name that doesn't get used so much anymore. But why? It's funny. One thing that's different about it, Ebenezer is not the name of a person in the Bible. It's a name of a thing. And it's Hebrew for stone of help. And so why the guy's raising an Ebenezer is, he's raising up a little monument, maybe a big one, but probably a little monument, to mark something that's happened that he's grateful for. Specifically, help that he's got from God. And so thought about times when, you know, maybe in these modern days we kid ourselves and we say we don't use symbols as much. You know, we don't use formalism and ceremony and all that kind of stuff. But we really do still have our little things that we do to help us remember important times and so on. I mean, some of them are obvious, like we still use gravestones. My parents were cremated and their ashes were scattered and there was no gravestone, and so I still took stones from the spot where we scattered my mom's ashes, and later on the same spot we scattered my dad's, and I took those stones, and those are like Ebenezer, right? They're to remind me of my parents. I can't go down to Arizona where their ashes are scattered, but I can look up on the mantle and see those stones. And there's a lot of other examples. Some are probably very valuable and some are probably silly, like cheese heads and those big foam fingers and stuff. You know, I'm not a football guy, but anyway, we use symbols. And we got to be careful because sometimes we substitute symbol for substance. The symbol is to remind us of the substance, not to be the substance. You know, an obvious example of that is with idol worship, right? You make a little statue, and it's really, when they first made the statues, it was to represent a god, but they would fall into the tendency of thinking the statue itself had these magical powers. And that can happen within the Christian realm as well. You know, if we're not careful, we'll make little, I don't know. I'm not going to use examples because I'll offend somebody, but, and I'll be doing plenty of that later probably. So why start now? Another very powerful symbol is the ark. Now, when I say ark, do you think Noah's ark or Ark of the Covenant? And why did they use the same word, and why do we never use it for anything else? There's actually a couple of different Hebrew words that get interpreted as ark, and an ark is a container for preserving things. And so the priests that worked in the temple actually had an ark where they kept some stuff that they used in their ceremonies and so on. But the Ark of the Covenant was a very special chest, about as big as this table, that they kept the tablets that had the Ten Commandments written on them that Moses had brought down from the mountain, the second pair after he broke the first pair. And they kept them in there, and he had some other things in there. But and there were two golden angels molded on top with their wings spread out, touching each other. And that stayed in the Holy of Holies, which was the back part of what was first the tabernacle or the tent where they did worship, and then later on was the temple, special separate area that nobody went into in those days except for one priest, maybe once a year, I think it was. So the That ark, the Ark of the Covenant, was a symbol of the presence of God. And now God's everywhere. God's omnipresent. But he let his people know, the Jews know, that he would be present in a special way in the temple at this ark. And so they knew that, and they knew that was a symbol, but they fell into problems. By the way, ask yourself, as you're thinking about all this, what are times when something big happened in my life where I was helped by God and I could raise up an Ebenezer? It doesn't have to be a real stone, but some way of remembering something big that happened. Okay, what's that? Yeah, there you go. So those kind of things come, right? So, you can forget. I've been a Christian for, three decades, I guess, close enough. And some really big things have happened, and I can forget them if I'm not careful. So it's good to have marker points. A really bad thing happened was the Israelites lost the Ark of the Covenant to the Philistines, which are their enemies that live nearby. They live kind of along the coast of where Israel is now. And this was back in the days before kings. They were led by judges, which just means leaders, really. And Samuel was their leader. They were fighting, and in 1 Samuel chapter 4 it says, "Now the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer. It's named Ebenezer because of something that happened later, but anyway. They camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel. As the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. When the soldiers returned to the camp, the elders of Israel asked, 'Why did the Lord bring defeat on us today before the Philistines?' And they said, 'Let us bring the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Shiloh,'" which was where the tabernacle was set up, "'so that he may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies.' So the people sent men to Shiloh, and they brought back the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim," the angels, "and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant. When the Ark of the Covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook. Hearing the uproar, the Philistines asked, 'What is all this shouting in the Hebrew camp?' When they learned that the Ark of the Covenant had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. 'A god has come into the camp,' they said. 'Oh no, nothing like this has ever happened before. We're doomed. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness.' 'Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight.' So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died." They tried to use the Ark as an idol. They said, "You know what? If we have this Ark with us, that means God's with us. And then who's going to mess with us?" And the Philistines, oddly enough, kind of agreed with them. Wow, this is terrible. But instead of that fear causing them to fight less, they decided, "We need to fight harder." And they defeated the Israelites. Really interesting that they would, in their minds, go back and get the Ark to show that God is with them. And then get beat. In a sense, because for the second time, but still, in a sense, because God is with them. During the Civil War, somebody asked Abraham Lincoln whether he thought God was on the Union side or not. And Abraham Lincoln said, "Sir, my concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side, for God is always right. You see, now that's something we really need to remember. Because with a lot of bad things are happening in our nation now. A lot of bad things are happening in the world. I got to tell you, it's been that way all along, ever since sin came into the world. Now, I'm not saying that we're necessarily okay as a nation. Everything's going to get better. In fact, I'm thinking it's probably going to get worse. But the fact of the matter is, if we take this attitude that we're the church and God is on our side, we're in big trouble. That's us using God as our mascot, to use an offensive word, as our genie. I'm going to pray to him and get what he's going to come help us because we asked him to. Okay? Should we ask him to help? By all means. But he's not our pet. He's not our genie. He's the one in charge. He's the Lord of Lords, the Lord of Hosts, the God Almighty. We're not in charge. So we don't go fetch him and use him to fight our battles. We ask him if we can cooperate with him to fight his battles against whoever he wants us to, right? So let's keep that in mind, because we can get awfully snooty, prideful. And the sad thing about it is, you suffer when you get prideful. Because eventually, what do they say? Pride goes before the fall. It's like these Israelites. They're all thundering with noise. We've got the ark. We've got God with us. And they're just like totally pumped. And bam, 30,000 of them get killed. That's what happened. That's the kind of thing that can happen to us. Maybe not get killed, but wind up looking awfully foolish when we go charging in, thinking, that, come on, God, come show everybody how great, you know, how great we are and how much we know what we're doing and how screwed up they are. That's really a formula for disaster. Now, the way they got the ark back, by the way, because they did get it back, was the presence of God, in the sense that I talked about, really was with the ark. And the Philistines had no respect for it, but they, to them, it was booty. It was something they won in the war. And so they kept it as a trophy, and that's another bad thing to do. And so they started to have a plague of rats and a plague of tumors. I didn't describe the tumors exactly, but their women were barren. So things got ugly among the Philistines, and they began to realize it's because they had that ark sitting. And actually, probably what gave them a hint is some people lifted up the lid of the ark to look inside and see what was there, and they fell over dead. So clearly they were having problems with this ark. So they said, what should we do? And they said, well, we'll get a couple of cows that haven't ever pulled anything before, that have had calves, and we'll put the calves over in a pen, and then we'll hook up the cows to a cart, and we'll just let it go and see what happens. Now, the idea was the cow normally will go back to the calf that's bawling and wanting its milk. But in this case, the cattle just went without stopping, shoom, straight back to Israel. And so they knew there was something out of the natural going on. And as a tribute to God, as a way of saying they were sorry for taking the ark, they filled it full of gold rats and gold tumors. And I always think, gold tumors? That's gross, man. But, you know. It was their way of saying, oh, you know, look, we're going to put these little idol thingies in here, and we're sorry. It got back to Israel, and in 1 Samuel chapter 7, it says, the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They brought it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar, his son, to guard the ark of the Lord. The ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim a long time, 20 years in all. I don't know why they didn't take it back to Shiloh where it belonged in the tabernacle. There's a whole other story. It makes a great sermon later on about how it gets back there finally. But for now, it stays at this guy's house for 20 years. And during that whole time, the Israelites were still having to fight the Philistines all along. Now, you remember the Philistines? That's where Goliath came from. He was a champion of the Philistines. That fighting just went on and on. And God was always using them as a way to castigate the Israelites. It says in chapter 7, right after talking about the ark being back in Kiriath Jearim for 20 years, it says, then, so it wasn't real sudden, 20 years, right? Then all the people of Israel turned back to the Lord. So Samuel said to the Israelites, if you are returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths, and commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only, and he will just deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the Israelites put away their Baals and Ashtoreths and served the Lord only. Now, Baal, Ashtoreth, it's just the name of idols. So they let idol worship creep in. It was the name of gods that were basically demons. They worshiped demons. They didn't think they were, but one of the ways you could tell is one of the main means of worshiping Baal was to burn your children alive as an offering. So it's not considered to be wholesome worship in most Christian churches. You know, I mean, think about just how that just always blows my mind. Of course, we abort them. So when I say we, I'm not picking on any one person here, but you know, as a nation, unless we get we'd never do something like that. We should probably remember that we're killing lots and lots of babies. When the Philistines, then Samuel said, "Assemble all Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with the Lord for you." When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and there they confessed, "We have sinned against the Lord." Now Samuel was serving as leader of Israel at Mizpah. When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. When the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. They said to Samuel, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines." But do you see the difference? They confessed their sins. They put away their idols. They let God know, "You're in charge, Lord. We're really sorry that we've been doing all these stupid things." And not only that, we know that we need to continue to pray to you and have our leader turn to you, Samuel, turn to you and continue to pray for us, because we're not going to do this without your help. They didn't take God as a mascot. They asked God how they could cooperate with him and come out of this thing alive against their enemies. When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. Then Samuel took a suckling lamb and sacrificed it as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him. While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day, the Lord thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. This time the Philistines were scared, and they were scared of God directly thundering at them. Not the idea that there were these gods that the Israelites had with them, but God himself, the one true God, was thundering at them, and they basically destroyed themselves. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines. They had to chase them to kill them, slaughtering them along the way to a point below Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shin. He named it Ebenezer, which meant stone of help, a marker that God had helped them, saying, and Samuel said, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." I like the fact that he said, "thus far." It's not kind of like, "Oh, good, we finally repented, and now from now on, God's going to just kill." It's like, We repented. We did the right thing. We said we would serve with God. And thus far, we see that that is the way to behave. And if you read the Old Testament, you'll see that the Israelites went back and forth between thinking that either God was their mascot or they had little special idol gods that they worshipped and so on. And then they'd have to get reminded that there's one true God and they serve Him. He doesn't serve them. The symbols aren't any good. It's good to have a symbol. It's good to have a reminder. But that stone was no good unless their hearts were right. It just occurred to me that their hearts were like the stone if their hearts weren't right. It was hard. Useless. You know, there's an example of, hey, you guys read the Bible too. After Gideon had won a Bible, won a big battle, they gathered up a bunch of gold and made a gold breastplate. And it could have been a symbol to remind them of their defeat, of their enemy. And it was at first, that's why it was made. But after a while, the people began to worship it. Go further back than that, God asked Moses to... God was angry with the Israelites at one point in their wanderings, and He sent serpents to attack them, and He told Moses to make a bronze serpent and put it up on a pole, and that would stop all the snakes. Now, when He made that, it was obedience to God, making the symbol that God said to make, and it worked, and the people stopped getting killed by snakes. However, later on, the people began to worship the snake, which that's not good. But in that kind of thing, you can see it happen all through, especially the Old Testament. And I think it happens in the New Testament too, and I think it happens now, but it's usually not quite so physical. It's not quite so, tangible. And maybe that's a mistake we make. We do use physical symbols to remind us. We certainly use the cross. For me, I know, I'll speak for myself, and other things, that the Bible, we hold a Bible. That's, I feel a little funny up here without one, because, as a preacher, that's what you do. You wave it around, right? Or you hold it open like this. And it's a symbol. You don't want to worship that book, okay? Then you wind up like the Muslims, where I could burn a Bible up here and you'd kill me for it. It's the Word of God. That's what's holy. Okay, but the paper and all that, that's not it. It's an Ebenezer because it reminds us that God's in charge and He's the one where all truth comes from. That's, if we want to know what's true, if we want to know what's right and good, that's where we can find it. It's not any good if we read it with the attitude of, I'm a Christian, and I'm pretty good. I think I'll get some good verses out of here to go hit people over the head with. That's when we turn it into the snake that gets worshipped, or the gold breastplate that gets worshipped. We start worshiping it. There was a place that Barbara and I went in France that just blew my mind. It's called Mont Saint-Michel. There's an island just off the coast, south of Normandy, but still kind of in the northern part of France. And the island is pretty much a big solid rock. And it's just far enough out that when the tide comes in, it's an island. And when the tide goes out, you can walk across the sand to get to it. There's actually a causeway that goes out there now, but there wasn't back in the old days. And so the beauty of it is if you try to surround it to lay siege to it, when the tide came in, it washed you away. And it's really amazing. They say the tide comes in as fast as a horse can gallop. And it's amazing. You can stand. We stood on the ramparts of the wall of the city. It's a small city. It's an island. And watch that tide come in. And it just comes rushing in. And it goes from being bare sand. And the people parked there who are visiting there during the day, they park their cars down low. And if they don't get out there and move their cars are completely covered in water. I mean, the tide comes up higher than the tour buses that are down there. So, fast. It's really amazing. And they And the way it got started is there's an abbey built at the very peak of that big rock. And it was kind of a little building. It was built in 800 AD. Can you imagine that? 1,200 years ago. And they gradually turned it into this huge cathedral. I call it a cathedral. I guess it was still an abbey, but it looked like a cathedral. Only looked like, it's like your fantasy book picture of a cathedral. It's so fantastic. And when you go down into the basement, there are these pillars holding the upper structure that have been carved out of the solid stone. And they're so big that like two or three people would have to hold hands to be around one pillar. And while we were down there, Barbara said something, and I don't remember what it was, but it got me to thinking about, were they proud of this structure and think what hotshots they were? Or were they humble and offering to God a symbol, this is how much we care about you, God. And I just had this picture in my head of two guys with chisels, and that's the way they did it. That's just amazing to me, a hammer and chisel, and you're making these pillars this big, this gigantic stone thing. And one's on one side of the pillar, and he's chipping away, and he's going, man, when people see this thing, they're going to know that Christians are hot stuff, you know. Check this out, you know. Boy, do we love God or what? And the guy on the other side of the pillar was a hammer and chisel, and he's chipping away, and he's going, oh, Lord, I'm so humbled. It's just astonishing that we could even make something like this, and you enabled us to do it. It's my prayer that we'd be reminded of just how great you are by this, which, although it's magnificent, is really nothing compared to you, right? What a difference. And that could be happening. I think that could have happened. I actually did, you know, because I was really into, I didn't grow up in the church. I wasn't a Christian until I was 30-something. And when I saw fancy churches and stuff, I thought, oh, those people, what's with all that? Because I was a kind of a pseudo-hippie. And so, like, it needed to be real plain and simple. And then if it was made out of wooden boards or something, then I thought it was cool. But if it was all fancy and stuff, then I thought it was fake, plastic, phony. They didn't really believe it. But that's not it. It's the heart. And that's the way it was for those people. And century after century, that thing was there, and they kept expanding it, and they built a whole town around it. And for every single person on that island and every single person that came to visit, they had to make a choice. Am I going to think this shows how cool Christians are because we can make such big cathedrals? Or am I going to say that this is an Ebenezer, a stone of memory, that helped me remember how great God is and how blessed I am to be helped by Him and forgiven by Him? I have some personal Ebenezers I'll share with you briefly. There are things that happened during the last 30 years that I've been a believer, 30 plus. One I know I've told many of you about, is I didn't believe in God, but I was pretty heavy into alcohol and drugs. I was going Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and they were saying you got to have a higher power, and I got, basically the way I look at it, I was so humbled by all the problems I was having that I was willing to consider that there might be a higher power. And I started studying a lot of New Agey kind of Jungian philosophy and stuff like that. And I came to the conclusion that God was kind of like our collective unconscious, you know, and that brought this power to us that we could use to overcome things like drugs and alcohol. And I read an article in Reader's Digest, I think it was, about a lady who was challenged by a friend. The friend said, you're Catholic, right? Do you really believe in that? And she goes, oh, I believe. She goes, well, how do you learn about God? And the lady thought to herself, well, how do I learn about God? I go to church, but that's about it, you know. So she set a time for herself every morning to get up and spend a half hour praying. And perhaps she read the scriptures. I thought to myself, it's really funny how things work. I thought to myself when I read that, you know, if I'm really serious about understanding God, then I should get up early every morning. Man, Julia was, our oldest daughter was 6 months old, so this was 32 years ago. And she cried all night long. We never got any sleep. So getting up a half hour early was a big deal, you know. But I was determined I was going to figure out who God was. And what I've often said is one morning I went in, and I usually sat on the sofa. I sat down on the sofa, and I thought, I just got to think about what my concept of God is. And God spoke to me and said, I'm not your concept. You're my concept. Amen. I fell off the sofa, literally, onto my knees. And I never got on my knees for anybody, you know, to pray or anything. And I was stunned, and that's an Ebenezer. Because any time now in the 30 years since when I doubt, why isn't God hearing me, or what's going on, or why is the church doing this, or blah, blah, blah. I think, you know, there is no question in my mind that that happened. That stands, and it's been 30-plus years, but it's very vivid in my mind, partly because I tell the story over and over again. But another time, not long after that, we used to gather, some of the men gathered what for me was pretty early, 6:30 or 7 on Wednesday mornings, and had a prayer group, and one of the guys had a little cabin behind his house with a wood stove in it. It was kind of cool. We'd get together there, and we'd pray. And I was feeling spiritually supercharged, you know. So I'm praying, and I thought, Lord, give me a glimpse of your eternal perspective. And I'm just thinking the heavens are going to open, and angels will be singing, and all that kind of stuff. I was so pumped, you know. And right in the middle of that prayer, it, with my eyes closed, it was as if a chasm, a well of darkness, infinitely deep, was below me, and all I could hear were the screams of those who had been separated from God forever. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. I started crying immediately. I cry. Guys cry, but I don't cry that easily. But man, I was sobbing, crying, because it just was, and it was a, it was like a millisecond. If it hadn't been any more, I think it would have killed me. That's the way it felt. It was so intense. That's an Ebenezer. A strange kind of Ebenezer, but it's a thank you, God, for saving me and for offering salvation. About the same time period. A lot of these things happen early in my walk. I have some that happen later. But about the same time period. Before Dave was pastor, if you can imagine that. He's been pastor here, I think, 26, 27 years. But before that, there was a guy named Carl Cully, and the church was, if you think we're small now, we just needed the blue chairs then, I think. But it was pretty small, a little bigger than that. And I'm not going to get into the whole teaching of tongues and interpretations today, but if you've heard of that, you've heard about this idea that sometimes someone could speak in another language, and then somebody else in the congregation could interpret it, and thus God could instruct us of something. And I had my doubts about that, but you know, I was pretty bought into it. But I certainly didn't want to have to do it. Right in the middle of the service, a lady stands up and starts, you know, speaking this gobbledygook stuff. And it was a lady that I knew was a complete flake. And she's not here. And none of you even know who I'm talking about, because this is so long ago that I think there's one person in the room that maybe knows who I'm talking about. But she was a flake to the point where she had called Barbara in the middle of the night and said demons were crawling all over her, and she had a gun. And I pray that she's close to Jesus, but she had had this horrendous childhood and early youth and all, and drug addictions and all this kind of stuff. And she was still really messed up. But she comes out with this word. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right. Here we go, tongues and interpretation, right. And Carl, the pastor, says, I want each one of you to pray. And I thought, oh, that there will be an interpretation. He goes, that you personally will have the interpretation. I don't want to pray that. but I prayed it, and sure enough, it was just like, boom! I felt like, I know what she said. It was just such a strange feeling. And I don't know why I used the mic, because I had that loud voice, but I guess they turned me down. But this big voice that I have, I stood up and I said, you've heard the truth, now you must decide. Somebody else confirmed it, said, yeah. What I learned later was there was a lady sitting immediately in front of me, and the sister of someone who went to the church, who was there for the first time, who was struggling with whether or not she would accept the Lord. And she got blasted right into the back of her head. You've heard the truth, now you must decide. And when the moment the service ended, she jumped out of her chair, went straight to the pastor and said, I want to read. I didn't find that out until years later. And actually 30 years went by before I wound up telling this friend, that time your blah, 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 it was your sister. He goes, really? That was you? And they told me, he and his wife said, we were going to that church for a while. We didn't know about this whole tongues and interpretation, especially the wife. She said, I had my big doubts about that. And she goes, then I saw that happen, and I thought, oh, whoa. That's an Ebenezer. I'll give you one more very personal one. This more recent, 8 years ago, I had my knee replaced. And I had an arthroscopic surgery that bunged it up, made it worse instead of better, to the point where I was in a wheelchair for a couple months. I used a little electric go-karts. And when I went to Safeway, I had to use those little electric carts, with the basket in there. Boy, you talk about being humbled. Oh, man. And I'd like to hear them. Anyway, I was in a lot of pain, and I overdid it with the opiates, and they were prescribed. I wasn't cheating. I was taking what he gave me, but pain was so bad that after they released me from the hospital, I went into spasms and stuff. And Barbara had to drive me back, and they said, we don't have a room. And I said, that's okay. I'll just lay here by the desk until you do. And I laid down at the admission, twitching in pain. Oddly enough, they found a room right there. I got to the point where I was taking 350 milligrams of oxycodone a day, which is it's like 100 Vicodin, roughly, because Oxycontin's a little stronger than hydrocodone. So if you've ever taken a Vicodin because you had a toothache or something, it's like taking 100 of those a day. And I got really addicted, and then the doctor said, okay, now start tapering off. And every time I'd take 10 or 20 milligrams less than 350, I'd get sick. And I went to the surgeon goes, he says, I just get people on these drugs. I don't get them off. So you're going to have to go see somebody else to get off. And I went to my family doctor, and he said, oh, man, 350 milligrams. You can't do this. You're going to have to go to Serenity Lane. And so I did the intake with the Serenity Lane guy, and he found out that I also take medication. I have an anxiety disorder, and I've had it my whole life for that. He goes, oh, you're going to have to quit that, too, at the same time. It's also very – and I'm thinking, holy moly, this is going to be like – hell. And especially they only do it as long as you're in. You got to get it all done. And I went home with Barbara, and I literally fell to the floor crying. And then this time I was really crying. Dude, this is horrible. Bad enough the way it is. Now I got to stop taking the pills. Oh, man. I'm crying. And I'm crying out to God, help me, please. And I just felt this nudge. Read Psalm 119. That's the really long one. And I could barely breathe because I was crying so hard. I'm so seriously, I was doing that thing you do when you sob and all that. But I laid on the bed next to Barbara, and I opened up the Bible, and I started reading, and it was pretty slow at first because I had to keep stopping to sob and everything. But as I read through Psalm 119, and as I got toward the end, I just felt this incredible sense of so I told the doctor, I'm going to stop. I should have said I was going to stop on my own. I should have said, I've got somebody to help. it was a missed opportunity. But nonetheless, it took about 3 months. And I was sick 3 months. I was really sick. It's not like God just said, okay, now if you've been through this. And, it's a funny thing. There's so many people who are abusing opiates now, abusing or using opiates, that I can look all around here and know that there's a bunch just because that's the way it is. Well, if you've stopped, then you know how ugly it is. Stop. Everything hurt, nose run, feel like. But the whole time, God's after 2 or 3 months, have been with that problem. That's an Ebenezer. I can't hear the word Psalm 119 without thinking about all that, thinking about how God got God. So that's the end of my sermon. My exhortation to you is to remember God is not your mascot. He is your ever-present help in time, but he's not taking orders from you. He's not doing it the way you want it, but can come to in humility. Ask him for that help. And when you've gotten it, take a moment, something to help. Journal, a rock somewhere. Do something. You're going to need it later on. Bad times come. You're going to need to be able to look back and say, I know.